From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we hear from one of the MLive investigative reporters who found factories around the state are releasing toxic PFAS chemicals at high levels.
They ended up starting to test all of the platers, all of the certain types of industry, and it's snowballing from there.
We'll talk about a lame duck session proposal to remove protections from some wetlands, lakes, and streams.
We are the Great Lakes State. And water is in our DNA and is vital for outdoor recreation. It's vital for tourism. And it's really vital for the whole pure Michigan concept.
Supporters of the bill say it's time for private property rights to be protected. We look at a power grab by the Republican-dominated legislature before the Democrats take over the executive branch.
There are often intended and unintended consequences of bills that are really rushed through.
All those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Michigan is a hunting and fishing state. It's also got a lot of people who want to conserve and preserve natural areas. Now, when the hook and bullet crowd comes together with the tree huggers against legislation, they are a formidable political force. In a joint letter, Ducks Unlimited, Michigan United Conservation Clubs, Michigan Trout Unlimited, and National Wildlife Federation outlined their opposition to a bill by Senator Tom Casperson that would remove protections from much of Michigan's wetlands, inland lakes, and streams. Joining us now is the Agriculture Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council, which also opposes this legislation. Tom Zimnicki, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with the basics. Why do we protect swampland? What's so important about wetlands and marshes?
Well, wetlands, marshes, lakes, and streams, I mean, those are all vital to not only the health of the ecosystem in Michigan, using those resources to help funnel out pollutants and contaminants like that. They also help control flooding issues on a local level. And then that's just fundamentally, it's part of Michigan, right? We are the Great Lakes State, and water is in our DNA and is vital for outdoor recreation. It's vital for tourism, and it's really vital for the whole pure Michigan concept.
So how much of Michigan's wetlands would we lose if these protections are removed?
So this would open up around 500,000 acres for possible development, dredging, filling, diverting of water, and then around 4,000 to 6,000 inland lakes in Michigan as well.
For years, I've heard farmers and some legislators complain that these protections are a hindrance because it means farmers can't drain some little mud hole that doesn't even hold water some years. How valid is that complaint?
There's been long concern, as you mentioned, about kind of this inability to use my land as it is. What we're talking about here are not little wet spots on the fields. What we're talking about in this bill would totally overhaul large lakes, large wetland systems. And so while that is certainly a concern, there are the purpose of this bill or the intent of this bill goes way beyond any of those little spots in the field.
Senator Casperson stresses this is about private property rights. I have a right to do with my property as I please. Why should the government interfere? Why should the government interfere with protections on wetlands?
Because the benefits that wetlands afford us are immense, and they don't just affect private property or one individual property, but things, again, like flood protection, like tourism, like hunting and fishing. I mean, those are things that not only all Michiganders utilize, but those are things that tourism and our tax dollars really depend on. And so by eroding protections around all of these wetlands, lakes, and streams, we're not only damaging, the personal property, we're not only going to affect that individual property, but it's going to be a much wider spread effect.
This, as you've alluded to, affects protections for inland lakes, some headwaters of streams, some man-made wetlands specifically made to give fish and fowl some breeding grounds. So how will protections change for those spots?
Right now, it looks like the protections for those under the language of the bill, a lot of those are going to disappear. And the bill also introduces a lot of uncertainty around what happens with our state program to administer the Clean Water Act and to to oversee the protections of these water bodies. And the bill introduces a lot of uncertainty around what that interaction between state and federal government is going to be, and which of those wetlands are going to be ultimately regulated.
Besides being a cushion for big-time rainfall and preventing some flooding, these are really important to wildlife species. How important?
Hugely. And you hit on it with some of the breeding ground for waterfowl and certainly migratory fowl. Some of these smaller streams that I think are kind of the poster child that folks hold up and say, well, the government wants to come in and regulate this little stream in the back of my field. But those little streams feed bigger wetlands. They feed bigger bodies of water that are essential for threatened and endangered species. And species, again, that folks in Michigan and people that come to the state rely on for things like hunting and fishing.
Is this bill going to pass in lame duck session?
Well, Lester, you know as well as I do, it's lame duck's a fairly unpredictable time. Certainly everything is on the table right now, and given the impacts that this bill is going to have on Michigan's wetlands, lakes, and streams, we are certainly pushing for the legislature to reject this bill, and if it goes beyond that point, certainly for the governor to understand the vast impacts that this bill would have, and for him to reject it as well.
Tom Zimnicki is with the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you, Lester.
Let's turn now to a group which supports the Casperson bill, which would remove protections from some of Michigan's wetlands. Charles Owens is the state director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses in Michigan. Welcome back to Stateside.
Good to be here.
So why do you think removing these protections is good for Michigan?
Well, we don't view it as much as removing protections as providing a process for small property owners primarily, that would be small businesses and individual citizens, to have some kind of a level playing field when they're dealing with a large agency like the DEQ, particularly when it comes to disputes over how they might want to use their property.
So these wetlands and streams that might be in private hands, they're connected to and they have impact on public streams, rivers, and wildlife. And they're, the cradle of life for frogs and ducks and geese and fish and all kinds of other wildlife. With the frog populations down, fish populations in the Great Lakes down, mallard duck populations on the decline, is this the right time to remove protections?
Well, again, I don't accept the remove protections. This has been a controversy for many, many years. The Clean Water Act primarily allows the federal government to regulate navigable waters. And then over time, that definition of what constitutes a navigable water has been chipped away to the point where water systems that probably are not navigable waters have been regulated by the Clean Water Act. And the states typically are charged with regulating waters that are not considered navigable and would not be covered by the Clean Water Act. But what we've seen recently is the EPA continuing to encroach on states' rights to regulate their water systems.
Well, representing businesses, I'm wondering what kinds of problems are these current protections of wetlands, lakes, and streams causing business?
We've had situations over in Grand Rapids a number of years ago where a business wanted to expand their parking lot, and they got the local approvals necessary, and the property that it was adjacent to expand was just grass. I mean, it was just a level area that they didn't pave. And they went ahead and did the work, and lo and behold, suddenly the DEQ became involved and charged them with illegally filling a wetland. The definition has been stretched to the point where if water shows up once every 5-10 years, someone can make a case that this is a wetland. And in this case, the small business spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to resolve this situation. That's not the kind of atmosphere or environment that we think is conducive to economic development and, frankly, respects private property rights.
How common is a scenario like that?
It's very common. That's the reason for the bill. Particularly up in the north area, where Senator Casperson hails from, which is why he's sponsoring the bill, And he has indicated that it just never ends, the amount of problems they have with the DEQ and the DNR when it comes to private property rights.
Well, can't some of these disputes be resolved by some of these new boards, these oversight boards that have been approved by the legislature and the governor?
Well, they haven't come to fruition yet because that bill was just signed. That also has mainly to do with the development of rules, not specifically these kinds of disputes, which is the need for Senator Casperson's bill. And let me just emphasize here, it isn't right whether it's a large business or a small business or a citizen, but, you know, when the DEQ comes calling to a big corporation, they just lawyer up, and they're able to go toe-to-toe with them. The individual citizens don't have those kinds of resources, and the department uses that to bully them. What Casperson's bill attempts to do is set up a process where they can't do that, and that there is some process and some rights for a property owner to try and come to a resolution with the department instead of being intimidated and given a take-it-or-leave-it proposal, which is the way that a lot of these things are done right now.
I guess the real issue for the environmentalists, it seems, is what happens downstream if that wetland is paved over or if it's plowed up? That's going to have an impact on down the line. So is that a concern?
Again, you get to the definition of a wetland. A lot of these, what are being argued over as wetlands, most common sense people would not consider them to be wetlands such that the paving of them is going to create some kind of environmental calamity. Let me just say this with regard to the environmental groups. It's unfortunate, but it was apparent at the hearing. They think that all the land in the state of Michigan belongs to everybody, not to private property owners, and that they should be able to tell people what they can do and what they cannot do with their land. Now, if there is a case to be made on private property that there's a wetland that is contiguous to and has significant impact on streams, rivers, water quality, whatever, that's one thing. If it's just a low spot in someone's yard that collects water every now and then, I think it's a little bit of overreach for them to apply all of these rules and regulations to a poor property owner that just wants to make some improvements on their land, put in a logging road or an access road to property that they own, and to bully them through a process that's unfair and balanced towards the state and towards these environmental advocates and not the property owner.
Charles Owens is the director of the National Federation of Independent Businesses in Michigan. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Coming up, businesses are still releasing PFAS chemicals in large quantities around Michigan. Some releases are thousands of times higher than the federal guidelines. We'll learn more in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The lame duck session of the legislature is headed toward gutting the law on earned sick time and higher minimum wage, and it's looking at bills that would allow the legislature to intervene in court cases, and in a power play away from the Secretary of State would give supervision of campaign finance laws to a commission. Here to talk about those things are our Friday commentators, Ken Sikkema, Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican Majority Leader in the Michigan Senate, and Gilda Jacobs, the President and CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy and a former Democratic member of the Senate. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Lester.
Let's start with the paid sick leave law. It was a ballot proposal that the legislature took up and passed. Now it looks to be changing the law to essentially gut just about everything. Ken, this move by the legislature bucks the will of the people if polling is correct. The numbers show about 70% of those polled support the law as it was proposed. Why is the legislature in the midst of making these changes?
Well, there's kind of a lot of nuances to this. I think the Senate action is more than a little heavy-handed in terms of the extent to which they're going to modify it. But just kind of for the record, you know, I personally do not believe legislation should be done at the ballot box, which what initiated laws do, like the paid sick leave or the minimum wage and various and sundry others. And the challenge is when and if they get adopted by the voters, it's virtually impossible to amend. So that's kind of what has precipitated Republicans to try to amend it in the same session in which they adopted it, you know, sort of avoiding the ballot box issue and whether that's constitutional or not is going to be decided by the courts. I guess my point is I don't like the way this constitutional provision allowing the voters to initiate laws has been used of late. But I will also say I think the Senate action in terms of the magnitude of their amendment is more than heavy-handed.
Gilda, this is not the first time a lame duck legislature has done something like this. What do you think of it?
Well, I think the fact is that going to the ballot for some groups who are trying to get legislation passed is the only way they can have their voices heard when we have a state that is very gerrymandered and where we know that certain issues would never be taken up by the majority party. So this gives an opportunity for, and it's really, you know, very democratic with a small d, a democratic way for the people to still have their voices heard in a system that really has been designed to really stifle the voices of others in our state. And I do agree with Ken, this is a very heavy-handed approach to really gutting something that was really meant to help our lowest paid workers who really do need a break in the state.
For the record, the group that made the original proposal says it's prepared to take it back to the ballot in 2020, so we'll see how that goes. Next is this power play by the legislature to intervene in legal battles and put campaign finance supervision under a commission rather than Secretary of State. Ken, the Speaker of the House, Tom Leonard, who lost the race for Attorney General to Democrat Dana Nessel, says if he'd been elected, he would be in favor of letting the legislature intervene in court cases against the state because it's good government. What's your assessment?
This bill, this idea of allowing the legislature, either the House and the Senate or both, to intervene might be relatively benign. But my reservations about it is that I think it just needs to be vetted thoroughly in terms of what really does it mean. And it's probably the kind of issue you don't or should not take up in lame duck. You know, I'd like to have the state bar weigh in or the Law Revision Commission weigh in on it as to what it actually means and what the impact is, because I don't think anybody really knows. I think the rhetoric about how disastrous it is sort of overblown in the sense it might not be, but it might be. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of a weird answer to your question. I just don't think it's been vetted much.
Yeah, you're looking at both sides. That's good. I like that. Gilda, a good government or an attempt to undercut the incoming attorney general?
I think it's a non-well thought out attempt to cut the powers of the incoming attorney general. You know, Ken makes such an important point, is that there are, I think there's like over, I don't know, 100 of bills that may be taken up in lame duck. Some of them who really have not really been vetted properly. Research really hasn't been done well. You know, there are often intended and unintended consequences of bills that are really rushed through. I think this particular issue is very, very important. It really does need a deeper dive. If I was on the other side of the aisle, I would be concerned that some of the things that they would be doing in lame duck may come back to bite them again when there's a Republican governor or a Republican secretary of state or attorney general. We have to look at what's good for our state long-term, not what's good for a political party.
Another bill that would take supervision of campaign finances away from the Secretary of State and give it to a proposed Fair Political Practices Commission made up of 3 Republicans and 3 Democrats appointed by the governor. Ken, is this something better supervised by an appointed commission or a statewide elected official?
I think it's a silly bill. There's no evidence that this kind of campaign finance commission is a good idea. The federal level does it, and they're basically dysfunctional. And there's no evidence that the Secretary of State, going over many, many years, has done a poor job of regulating campaign finance. And I would point out it's been controlled by Republicans for 28 years. If they've done such a bad job, then this bill should have been introduced a long time ago. It's a solution looking for a problem.
Gilda, who should be in charge of oversight of campaign finances in Michigan?
I'm going to let Ken Sigma be in charge. His responses are so reasonable. You know, we have a system that has worked well it should continue to work in the same way that it's been. So again, I would totally agree with Ken that this is a solution looking for a problem. You know, it's a very political solution. You know, I think at the end of the day, and maybe this is where you want to, you know, have this conversation go, my hope is that Governor Snyder, who has really been, you know, such a kind of a good moderate thinker with a lot of different issues, will really look at these bills. You know, nobody tried to go in and curb his abilities and his powers or any of the powers of our state officers now, you know, that he will veto these bills that are really, you know, not good government bills that, you know, are really an attempt to gut the power of the incoming administration. So I'm hoping he will do the right thing, you know, at the end of the day and say these bills are very undemocratic and they really don't reflect the will of the people of the state.
You know, the irony of this move is that Secretary of State-elect Jocelyn Benson is one of the nation's leading experts on campaign finance. So
absolutely.
Seems like an ironic time. I've got one more quick question for both of you. If they do pass this bill that allows the legislature to intervene in legal battles, one of those legal battles will probably be about Proposal 2, the gerrymandering, anti-gerrymandering ballot initiative that passed. What do you think of that, Ken?
Well, the reason I say this idea might be relatively benign is we're simply talking about who can make arguments in a court on a certain issue. And, you know, I think all sides need to be represented. The courts, judges ultimately make the decision. And so that's kind of why I say that this might be just a modest idea that doesn't have a great impact. But once again, we just don't know. It just hasn't been vetted very thoroughly about how it would work. For example, if the House were to intervene on a case, do they have to take a vote on the House floor to get permission, or can the Speaker just do it? I mean, these are pretty important questions that haven't been answered.
Gilda, final thoughts?
I totally agree with Ken. And I think we have to look at there really is a separation of power the way government is set up, and it needs to continue that way. So I'm all for good government.
That is Gilda Jacobs, a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, a former Republican legislator. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. MLive has released an investigative report on large releases of PFAS chemicals still happening around the state. These releases are hundreds, thousands of times higher, and in one case, tens of thousands of times higher than the federal guidelines. That report was written by Paula Gardner and Garrett Ellison. Paula Gardner joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Lester.
While there are lots of PFAS chemicals, two are the most common, PFOA and PFOS. You were looking at levels of PFOS in wastewater treatment samples. First, how did you get the documents showing this is happening?
Oh, it started months ago. Honestly, it started even before I started gathering all of the wastewater treatment plant information. I ended up going to the Lapeer Plating and Plastics to look at the situation there, thinking that it would be a sidebar to a report that we did back in July. And I realized I just didn't have enough information to write that article. A couple months later, maybe 6 weeks later, I found out that there was a discharge from Wixom that was affecting the Huron River in Ann Arbor. And I ended up, through trial and error, requesting a number of documents to help me figure out how much was going out in that instance. And then when I kind of connected the dots to the state actually testing the wastewater treatment plants, I recognized that that documentation would live in all of the wastewater treatment plants that they were testing. So we started the process probably early September.
Do these wastewater treatment operations know the sources of the PFAS contamination?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing to me. The state started planning to look at the wastewater treatment plants back in February, and what they found was PFAS. And then so they went to the wastewater treatment plants and told them that not only do you need to test your own water, but we need to figure out what's coming into the plant. So they had them do a survey of all their licensed industrial customers. And that was a very mild process early on. It was like an intellectual exercise. They just had to go through things and say, well, they might have the PFAS, they might not, you know, and come up with their list of possible and probable causes. But as things progressed, and especially as some of the more higher levels became apparent, they ended up starting to test all of the platers, all of the certain types of industry, and it's snowballing from there. They're still testing. There are some treatment plants that haven't even finished testing all of the likely candidates yet. So it is still going on.
Yeah, you mentioned platers. What kind of factories are mostly releasing these high levels of PFAS into the sewers?
Yeah, it's the chrome plating industry that's mostly responsible for it.
The chrome plating, like the stuff we see on cars?
On cars, yeah. We all love our chrome, you know, our trim inside. Most of that is actually not solid metal anymore. It's chrome plated plastic, and there are a number of companies around the state that do that. There's other types of plating, too. They're making, like, gears for industrial equipment, things like that.
So are they still using PFAS?
So that's an interesting question. They have to use a chemical in their electroplating baths and in their production facilities that is, like, on the surface of the liquid to control the emissions from those baths of the dangerous chemicals in there, like the hexachrome. They don't want people breathing that in the plants. So the order has been that they have to have this surface chemical. And up until, you know, a few years ago, they were able to use the PFAS-related chemicals. They were told that they could not do that anymore. But they still use PFAS, PFAS-related chemicals. Some of them are considered okay. Some of them are being looked at now. None of them are regulated. And most of the platers will tell you that the PFAS-free chemicals that might be available actually don't work very well. And by not working, it means putting their employees at risk because of the other chemicals. It's an interesting situation for the platers. So they don't actually use the PFOS anymore, but the belief is that it still exists in their system. And there's also some speculation that the chemicals that they are using may turn into it during some sort of a chemical reactive process.
So this might not be just PFAS clinging to the sewer pipes or the outlet pipes. They might be actually inadvertently manufacturing PFAS.
That's some speculation, and I think that's something that people are worried about. But these chemicals are so persistent, so like cleaning the pipes or cleaning the sewer, you know, all of these things that they're taking or they're trying to do, they're stirring it up, or they're getting a decent reading, and then all of a sudden something else changes and they get a higher reading. It's amazing to me. It's like it's coming out of nowhere. You know, it exists in some little corner of their operation, and it just starts coming back in again.
Has the DEQ shut down any of these plants because of the release of this pollution?
None.
You quoted one DEQ official as saying the agency is working to reduce the pollution that's taking place. Quote, without causing a whole lot of extra regulatory oversight. That's very kind of them to the businesses that are polluting, but in the meantime, more of these toxic chemicals are being released into the rivers, streams, lakes, and groundwater in Michigan, and that's where we get our drinking water. Why isn't there a bigger rush to correct this problem in a way that stops this pollution immediately?
I think that's the best question out there right now after finding out all of this and then hearing the answers that I got. Nobody wants to shut down a business, no matter what level the PFAS is read at. And I've seen a number of reactions to that question. You know, I've heard a number of reasons. Initially, they told us before they would name any businesses, and I do want to mention, like, the state has not named a single business that's affected by this, except for Lapeer Plating and Plastics, which is the original one that was found back in 2017. So all of the businesses that were in this report, the state has not acknowledged that they're happening.
So it's only news media reports is the only reason we know where a lot of this PFAS is coming from right now.
Yes. So initially, you know, a conversation around Labor Day, I was told that they're still confirming a lot of these details. So they don't want to shut down anything where they don't have confirmed lab tests. The lab tests are taking 4 to 6 weeks. There's a ton of lab work being done. The labs cannot turn it around. So there's some hesitation to believe some of the reports. They want to do it again and see what the duplicate test will say. So there's that. There seems to be like a hesitation there. They don't want Michigan's economy to be affected. They don't want the platers to lose business. They believe that it's going to be a longer-term solution, so kind of a steady decline is something that is worth working toward. Some people are making the point that when they used these chemicals, they were illegal. So the fact that they exist now, like any kind of corrective step, is fair.
Not only legal, but required to safeguard the workers.
And required. Yeah.
Do we yet know how widespread these PFAS chemicals are in the state and how many factories are in operation and still releasing the chemicals?
We determined through our investigation that there are probably at least 50, with another 50, maybe 70, that need to be tested. And that's just the ones that the wastewater treatment plants identified as probable. So there could be some chemical companies that didn't end up on the list, or there might be something else, a paper company that didn't end up on a municipality's list. So this is a good reach, a good thorough look, but it's not complete by any means. And I think they're going to be doing this well into 2019. And when you ask, do we know, like MLive found out, but the state is not telling us how many are out there. There's no aggregate information about how much PFAS is coming in from industry, coming from the state level. And I think that was an important part of the story to acknowledge.
We've heard this story before, too. All right. Paula Gardner is a reporter for MLive. She and her colleague Garrett Ellison released an investigative report titled Businesses Discharging PFAS into Michigan's Waterways. Good work.
Thank you. We're going to keep going on this. It's a scary, wide open topic right now.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Lester.
Still to come, refugees who've arrived in the U.S. from difficult situations around the world often struggle with mental health issues.
It's sad news that the impact is so high, but the good news is that we have treatments. We have interventions. We can change people's lives.
We'll hear more about those treatments next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Some refugees from desperate situations around the world are fortunate enough to become accepted into the United States. But then what? If you've been in a war-torn area or a victim of torture, sure, you're glad to be safer, but now you're in a strange country. You likely don't speak English, you don't understand the bureaucracy, the medical system, and you're probably going to land in a sketchy neighborhood. Then there's the chance you're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or other issues. But you don't know that because you've never been diagnosed, and you might not even be familiar with the concept of PTSD or depression. Our next guests have taken upon themselves to help with some of those challenges. Dr. Aresh Javanbach is the director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State University's Department of Psychology. And Mohammed Al-Saud is a research assistant at the clinic. We first spoke with him back in April. Let's revisit that conversation now. So what prompted each of you to decide to work with refugees?
So we have this anxiety and trauma clinic at Wayne State University, and it's a research clinic. And Michigan hosts a large, used to host actually until a couple of years ago, a large group of refugees coming from the Middle East. One reason is that Michigan is a refugee-friendly state. At the same time, there's a large Arab community in Michigan. So it would feel more familiar with a lot of refugees to come to Michigan. So these refugees from Syria and Iraq have gone through very difficult situations, right? Situation in Syria before this was very stable, like here. Like one morning you wake up and you see that neighbors are being killed by other people that you don't even know. Your water is shut down. You don't have electricity. For day-to-day access to grocery or healthy water, you have to struggle. And you don't know if tomorrow you or one of your relatives or family members would be alive or not. And then if you get very lucky, you can get out of the country and be in a camp where you have to stay for a couple of years before you're vetted and you can come to a country like the United States. There was reports before this work that there's a high level of impact of traumatic experiences in refugees who are in Middle Eastern camps or in Syria. But we didn't have data about what's going on with them when they come to a safe country like America. So here they're far from the conflict zone. They have been away for about a couple of years. Some could argue that, well, so probably all the problems and issues and stresses are gone. But at the same time,
that stuff doesn't heal itself by itself.
Exactly. In our clinic, we have seen people who were traumatized years ago. They still carry the severe symptoms of trauma. So we decided to screen Syrian refugees and Iraqi refugees for usual common consequences of trauma and stress, including anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. Before getting there, let me just quickly say what is post-traumatic stress disorder, because to a lot of people, it's a concept. As you mentioned, a lot of refugees would not probably even know what this is. It's a condition that happens when people are exposed to extreme life-threatening situations of trauma, such as war, assault, car accidents, rape, gunshots, robbery, these situations, which can lead to symptoms of always being anxious, always being on the alert. The brain wants to protect the person against that situation happening again. And nightmares, flashbacks, and being socially isolated, very difficult situation. That often comes with depression and anxiety.
I want to ask Mohammed, you've actually worked with these people before you came to the U.S. You've worked with refugees in other situations. What did you learn in those experiences that you're bringing to this work now?
Well, I started working with refugees in 2005. I'm originally from Iraq. Once I left Iraq to Jordan, there was a flood of displaced people moving to Jordan, trying to settle there or just as transient point. At the time, there were many organizations and American universities conducting research in the field of psychiatry. The main goal of the research at the time in 2005 and 2006 was understanding the acceptance level of having a mental issue, along with how accessible help for each refugee is available in case they need one. We worked over the period of 2 years. At the time, we interviewed approximately between 500 to 600 refugees. At the time, we were surprised by how they were accepting the fact that it's not a stigma to have mental illness, although it is a stigma to go public with it.
Uh-huh.
So it was a matter of like the society point of view, more than the personal point of view for the disease or any issue they complain from.
Is that the case with the people you're working with now as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least my opinion.
Let's talk about some of the work that's actually happening. How many refugees have you assessed?
So Arab American Chaldean Council has clinics in Dearborn and Detroit metro area. Every refugee that walks into the United States has to do a physical health screening within the first month of their arrival. So our department had a good relationship with this nonprofit, ACC, and Mohammed and his team go to the ACC clinics every time a new refugee family comes in, and the doctor at the ACC tells them about this research study, and if they're interested, they will join our team for screening. We have been lucky that we have screened more than 94% or 95% of the refugees who were referred to us.
I'm sorry, what was the figure again?
94% of refugees.
Wow.
And that's important because it shows that it's a good representative of the total sample. So we screen for PTSD, anxiety, depression. We also look at some biological markers like genetics and inflammation. Unfortunately, the impact is high, very similar to what was found in the Middle East among refugees in the Middle East.
What kind of percentage?
1/3 of the adults screen positive for PTSD. That's comparable to Vietnam War veterans' lifetime PTSD rate. Nearly 50% screen positive for depression and anxiety. Same in children. In children, we don't see presentations of stress as much in the form of PTSD as we would see in adults, but we see more of anxiety. Nearly 60% of kids have high anxiety, and nearly 80% have separation anxiety, which makes it very difficult for a kid to want to separate from parents and go to school, go to explore, go to sleepovers, go to parties. So numbers are high.
You have a higher ratio of kids than adults, or how's that mix?
In terms of numbers?
Yeah.
Relatively similar. It seems like relatively each family has two kids. And these are families which most of these kids have both of their parents. So these are the luckiest kids, because a lot of kids lost a parent, lost a family member, lost both of their parents through the transition and through the war.
If you want a better idea about the numbers, we interviewed 125 families so far in phase one, which is in total 486 individuals. The flow of refugees has slowed down since last year.
Since Trump was elected.
Our plan was to continue collecting data, and then with the new administration policies, the flow of refugees significantly slowed down.
So once you make an assessment, then what happens?
So one part is like showing the impact, because if, let's say, 2% of the people are impacted, among 1,000 refugees, you would have 20 people who would need care. If it's 30%, it would be 300 people who need care. So this is the first step in need assessment. Then it comes to intervention. So it's also good for science, right? Because we are looking at the genetic, epigenetics, inflammation markers, a lot of research that we do about trauma to know what are the underlying neurobiological mechanisms of trauma and how we can address them in treatment. The next step would be intervention. How do we want to help these people? Because, well, it's sad news that the impact is so high. But the good news is that we have treatments. We have interventions. We can change people's lives because these are very debilitating situations. And with treatment, a person can be very more able to assimilate and go through the stress of new environment. So we have launched an intervention work. Traditional psychotherapy or medication treatments would be very difficult in this population because, number one, acceptance of the stigma of mental illness or medications is difficult. Besides, we don't have enough skilled therapists who are fluent in the culture and language.
Right.
So we launched this study where we bring a family, a mom and a child, and we recently started adding dads. Moms do mindful yoga and kids do art and dance therapy. It's basically a collaboration of many different parties, people from art school in the university, our department, Samaritas, which is a social service that provides transportation for free for the refugees. And we have been seeing good effects. Actually, Muhammad has been involved on the field, and he can tell you some of the experiences he has had.
So what are you doing for the dads?
Oh, for the dads, we have a new thing going on right now, which is high-intensity interval training in an attempt to decide whether it's useful or not for relief of stress and anxiety and what's the effect of it.
So this art therapy, dance therapy, this high – what did you call it again? High-intensity interval training. Okay. Is that as effective as counseling or medication?
So number one is that can you get the medication and counseling to this population? In general, we don't have enough therapists who are familiar with treatment of trauma and PTSD, even for American citizens. So it will be much more complicated when you want to bring people who know the language and the culture. With these interventions, there's evidence from previous studies that they work, but those evidences are mostly qualitative. So we, because we are a research clinic, we are not only doing the intervention, but also brought a research component to this. So we measure the stress level before and after the interventions. We also look at inflammation markers because inflammation is something which is in the body and in the brain when these conditions happen. I just was looking at some of our data because the first was the feasibility. Would we be even able to bring these families to this, into these interventions, as you mentioned? So how much is the acceptance? Acceptance has been actually good. It also helps them do community building and become friends. And gradually we had, like in our first phase, has like four moms leave our intervention. Why? Because they found jobs, which was exciting to us. Anyway, so we have found decline in, we have enough numbers in children to look at the effects. We have had significant decline in the stress and anxiety among children. Now we're looking at the adults.
Let's talk about the research, and I assume you've been publishing on this. What are your peers saying? I mean, this is fairly unique in the nation, right? And there are other populations of refugees around the nation. Are your peers looking at this and saying, okay, now we've got some direction?
Yes. So actually, other people are slowly joining our intervention and research, actually. So we had people, another researcher from our university, another department, joined us to now look at like intergenerational transfer of trauma, like kids who were born after migration while mom was pregnant during the transition. How did mom's stress affect the infant? We also have been talking to people in Toronto, our colleagues in Toronto, who are interested in implementing our intervention studies. Besides that, there's a National Psychiatric Genetic Consortium, which is trying to pull a large group of people who are traumatized from all different backgrounds to look at the genetic vulnerabilities. So we are the first Middle Eastern population that joined this effort to, because this is a very unique genetically and ethnic group that we don't know the differences in genetic vulnerability compared to Caucasian and African-American population that we have mostly in those cohorts. We are also aware of other groups which are focusing on interventions and access to treatment.
So what's next for you guys?
So next is that we have established what was the impact of trauma when people came here. But then when you put a diagnosis for PTSD or depression on the person, it doesn't mean that they are marrying them to that diagnosis. That can change. So after a year, Mohammed and his team have started collecting data again on the same people to see What was the trajectory of symptoms? How did the symptoms in these people change, specifically kids? Because childhood trauma is very important in adults' mental and physical health. And then we are looking at psychological, inflammation, genetics, and environmental factors which can impact that trajectory so that we can identify those factors which are more important to be priorities to address. Because in 10, 15, 20 years, this kid is going to be an American adult citizen, right? And do we want him to be a successful, productive member of the society who is symptom-free and can contribute? Or do we want them to be the person who carried this trauma throughout their adulthood and was impacted all these years by it?
Arash Javanbakh is the director of the Stress, Trauma, and Anxiety Research Clinic at Wayne State University. Mohammed Al-Saud is a research assistant at the clinic. Thanks for coming in and telling us about your work.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
The team over at Wayne State is trying to figure out whether alternative therapies for stress and anxiety, think exercise or breathing techniques, can help refugees who have resettled in Southeast Michigan. Around the time we first spoke with Dr. Arash Javanbakh and Mohammed Al-Saud, stateside Sarah Leeson went to a yoga and movement therapy session at Hype Athletics in Dearborn Heights. She brought back this audio postcard.
So we're going to start in a seated posture and just want you to take a breath in and breathing out. Just sitting up nice and tall and just noticing how you're feeling today. And the mantra I like to use for this to kind of anchor my mind down is, that was then, this is now. My name is Lisa Malinowski, and I am a yoga instructor and mindfulness educator. And today I'm here helping out with the project at Wayne State and just teaching yoga to these lovely women that are here.
And then slowly coming back down into hands and knees, tabletop. And then let's inhale, lift our hearts off the bellies. And exhale, pressing into your palms.
I teach in the sense that it's trauma-informed, right? So these women have experienced something that I have never experienced personally in my life, but it's a powerful program. I think the ability to have this tool as someone who has experienced possibly such high levels of trauma in their lives, and to be able to have this safe space and learn how to be okay with feelings and uneasiness and change, and that really might benefit from this and find some peace in their future.
I'm Jenna Spinay. I am a dance movement psychotherapist, and I hold the movement therapy sessions here.
We're going to play musical chairs right here, so you might want to get out of
here. We play like 7-Up, they're like tag, and you play 11 games.
The first day was chaos and madness, as it always is, and really fragmented. And then over the weeks, I've just seen it increase exponentially each time, like the amount of community that we have in the space. And a lot of times they're introducing and requesting games that they remember playing at home, and then they'll teach them to each other and they'll play them together, and that's really lovely to see. And they're all movement games, of course, because you can play those anywhere. So that's been fun for me to learn and see, like, oh, I know that game, but I know it by a different name, and oh, the rules are kind of different, but let's play it together. And sometimes it brings up stories from home, and I remember one time when we played this game. So that's really nice to see.
My name is Ali Sayed. I'm the founder and CEO of Hype Athletics Community. You know, we all study human development. You have, you know, the mental, the cognitive, the physical, and the emotional, as well as the spiritual. So there's five major components. And physical development is definitely one that, you know, kids lack, especially in their upbringing. If they're in the middle of a war, you know, there's nothing that they can do for fun, you know. And that sort of takes their mind away from their negative thoughts and whatnot. But, you know, I've definitely have been able to witness the smiles on the kids' face, the excitement from even when they receive a snack to when they're going on the basketball courts to play basketball. The kids that I've had a chance to meet are just, you know, they're just innocent. You can tell. They just want to have fun like every other kid, you know. just the way that they're gonna get to that fun is gonna be a little bit of a challenge, but we'll make it happen.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, and Natalie Brennan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.